Hello and welcome to an Earth First radio special. Today we present the history of Earth First. This was presented around a campfire at the 2005 Round River Rendezvous in the Northern Cascades of Oregon. This program will be presented in four parts, and this segment is part three.
There's a cat named Barry Clausen. I don't know if any of you heard him. He was this infiltrator, a wannabe infiltrator, who was hanging out in Montana. And we got a call from Montana folk one day and said, hey, we think this guy might be coming your way. He's some kind of infiltrator. And I said, is he a Fed? And he said, no, he doesn't seem to have the savvy of a Fed. He must be in, you know, industry or somebody. So it's the first time we get a tip that we got an infiltrator coming. You know, and we think, should we just not work with him? Should we? And they weren't totally sure he was. But they said like 90-some percent sure. And I think, well, how often do you get to know who an infiltrator is and get to have a chance to see if they have any conscience or if you can crack them? And so this guy shows up and he's like, you know, pretends that he worked for a railroad company and he hates the logging in Montana and he wants to learn from us so he can go back to Montana and stop these clear cuts on Plum Creek land. Kind of older and just different vibe. Kind of came across as a good old boy engineer kind of guy. Is how he comes across the way now, too. Didn't know he's going to write a book, or we probably should have booted him. But I always figure, you know, he dreams, so maybe someday he'll crack. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, because we think we planted a lot of seeds. So he's around. We're trying to figure out what we can do with this guy. And we got this whole campaign in Seattle to protect their watershed. They're logging in this area where you can't hike to protect the water purity. But they're building roads and logging, and the whole city doesn't know about this thing because no one can go in there. And it's this really beautiful ancient forest. And so Barry has money and he has this good truck, and we all got shitty vehicles and no money. And, you know, we decided to do a tree sit, and we needed to get our gear up there. And so we'd always have somebody with Barry. We didn't quite tell him what we were doing, but then we, you know, needed him to drive us up the truck, and we have all this stuff. So he's driving his truck, and partway there, he goes, I got to go use the phone. And so we had already decided in advance always to send somebody with him. So goes, one of our folks goes, oh, yeah, I got to use the phone, too. And he goes and stands next to him so Barry can't make this call. And so we get the tree sit stuff all up there, and we hike it up over, and Barry's helping hike this stuff through the snow. And he helped us win this campaign. And... And so we get up there, and then we realize, you know, we hadn't really scoped it out. It wasn't marked. And we're going, shit, you know, what do we do with this stuff? And it's snowy still. And so we hide all the stuff. And in the morning, when the logger people show up, is this the such and such sale? And oh, yeah, it's right here. Where's the boundaries? So they show us. So we'd stashed all the gear. So the next morning, we go back and we start putting up the tree sit. And we come up with this idea to do a series, because we didn't have a lot of people. We didn't have the money for fines. A lot of us had a lot of arrests already. Came up with this idea to do like these actions where we were at Doom and then escape and do interviews under critter names to try to build up the publicity. Because we wanted to just get the city people to realize and to care about where the water came from and protect these forests. We thought it was a good chance to educate them about something. We do this tree sit. We get up there. It's cold. Everybody's telling us, you know, up in Washington State by Seattle, high mountains, the tree sit's a seasonal sport. And they're telling us we're in the wrong season. And it's still early in the year. I don't know, it was like March or something. So we go up, and two of the guys had been trained where we only had 20-foot platforms. And so they could do that really good. But the lines got set four times that or something. It wasn't a lot, you know, back then, 80-foot or something. I think they were the ones on the front with the banners. One of them gets halfway up, and he's sitting there hanging for a long time, just totally freaking out. And then finally goes up the rest of the way. We get down in the center and we do, you know, we get up and do our tree sits where they were starting to cut, which is farther away where the media couldn't see. But finally the media comes down and interviews us all. We get our press, and then the weather starts turning. The rain turns to snow, which turns to ice, and everybody's covered in ice. And the two guys in the front, the foresters, cops are there, and they talk them into coming down. And we're in the interior where they're not at, but we're freezing too. And we're going, shit, where's our support people? Because they just had disappeared and we think they're all busted. And we start thinking, and they'd been started cutting trees around us all day. And we're just feeling like, shit, this is just not cool. You know, we're not stopping any damn thing. Finally, we decided we'd come down and we'd escape and come back and do another thing. We thought we wanted to bring more folks. So the two folks up there getting nailed. We see some cop coming down the thing. I get him to do a rappel down, and I had my beard pretty long, and it gets caught up in the line halfway down. And I'm hanging there 50 some feet in the air, hanging by my beard. And I'm going with my hand, I'm looking like, where's the fuck the support? But I had my pocket knife tied to some parachute cord on me. So I cut up and I cut my beard off, you know, freed. So we got away and we brought the gear down and got away with the gear. And Forrester's kind of like ahead of the trail and we're escaping. And we're still wondering where support is. And so we go over to the car and support had all the keys and the cars are locked. I'm going, shit. So break into the car. I learned those skills as a young teen. It was one of my first professions. And found a bread tie and I hot wired it. And so we escape. Still wondering where support is. We think they were all arrested. And found out the next day when they show up in town that they had gotten really stoned, drank a bottle of wine, fell asleep, woke up the next day and we were all gone and they didn't know what happened.
you got to tell the 14 miles.
I know. And then what we came down for was to get a whole group of people to go back in and really stop it. And we did our interviews, too, under Critter Names on the radio and in the news media when we escaped. We called up the press, and Karen calls up the press. We get about 17 folk together. Karen calls up the press, the main news media in Seattle, and gives this guy exclusive coverage if he'll come with us overnight on an action in the watershed. And so, and we arranged, and he's the main news reporter on whatever their main station is. He says he wants to bring his cameraman. And we say, okay, but the condition is, and he wants to attend the meeting too, but the condition is he wasn't allowed to film people's faces, and he wasn't allowed to make any phone calls, and he had to stay with us the entirety of the time because we weren't him tipping anybody off, and he got exclusive rights. So he bit. And so we all go out early morning. We go out in the forest, and we fan out, and everybody stops the logging, and we're talking with these loggers, and some of them are angry, some of them are kind of half sympathetic. Oh, we fan out and just get between them and the trees. And, oh, yeah, and they go through the thing of trying, you know, we're going to cut your arms off later in the way of the tree, and, you know, and being all angry and aggro at first. News media is filming the discussion and our interactions, and we finally get some of the loggers talking, and it's really pretty neat. And the day goes, and things all stopped all day. The loggers finally leave, and the Forest Service is coming down. So the news media guy goes, I got to get this in. You know, they won't arrest me. Any of you want to come with me, you can help carry the camera. And we're going, I don't know about this, you know, because it's not supposed to be in this area. And so the news media guy goes up there with two folks who just help him carry his camera, and the cameraman and the news media guy get arrested. And so it made top of the news that night, and then later a whole hour-long special coverage called War in the Woods, which helped us win the campaign. So him getting arrested because he got really pissed at the Forest Service for what they were doing was awesome. And then the rest of us are there, so we figure, okay, it's time to escape. And so we start taking off, and we're walking quietly in the trail, and there's this kind of shape leaning in this tree, and suddenly I'm looking, and it's a guy in camo, kind of like top of everybody. Everybody stops, and finally somebody... he turned around, and we're like, bye-bye, and we'd start taking off through the woods, and there's this big steep slope, and it's some snow patches, and so we're kind of glissading down the snow, and he's going, wait, stop and talk, and we're going, bye-bye. He was pretty funny. He's one of their super Freddies that they seem to all be a little out of shape. So we're sliding and having fun, and it's getting dark, and we get farther down the ridge, and we're thinking our cars are way over there, and suddenly we watch our cars being towed away. It turns out to be a 14-mile hike out, but it's nightfall, and so we take this long parachute cord, and there's a whole bunch of us, and everybody grabs a hold of it because you can't see. We couldn't light any flashlights because they're out there looking for us with their cars everywhere and searchlights and driving up all the forest roads. So everybody's got a hold of this parachute cord, and the person in front would say, over log, under log, tree branch. And we'd just pass it down the line. And so everybody would just follow like a train. So we're going through the woods, and then finally we find this little spot, and we crash for the night, and everybody's freezing. And in the morning, we get out to the highway, and we're thinking, you know, we're going to hitchhike or catch a bus or whatever. And again, I wasn't supposed to get arrested or something because I was supposed to pick up Sasha. One of our people is there, like, to meet us, but we didn't know he's our people. So we hear this harsh voice, hey, over here! And we're thinking, like, shit, cops! And so everybody scatters, and Karen says, don't worry, you don't get arrested. And me and this other guy take off, and...
I gotta chime in.
Oh, yeah, okay. So we get onto the interstate, me and this one guy, and everybody else is kind of, like, ducking and hiding. Turns out it's one of our people. They all got to ride back to Seattle. Meanwhile, we're thinking we're escaping from this cops looking for us. He goes one way in the interstate to hitchhike, and I go the other way, so at least one of us will escape. I hitchhike this car coming from Alaska, telling them all about how, you know, what we did. They were cool folks. They had, like, Grateful Dead stickers all over. And so I'm telling them how we're just escaping from the cops, and they're helping me escape. I was just so elated, and because I got a ride right away. And I was really hungry, too, because we've been... Okay.
So anyway, the rest of us, we have to get a van, wait till van comes. We call and get a van to come out and get us. And then we're looking for these guys because they split all over the landscape. And so we drive way up the highway looking for Asante. And we stop at this restaurant. And there he is with this enormous plate about this long, piled high with pancakes, with white, with yellow, with bright red gop all over it. It's like there yellow number five, blue number six, whatever. It was about this high. He was just shoveling it down. We're going, oh my God, this is bad. But at any rate, then to cap off the story, okay, so they towed our cars, right? So we're all pacing around this guy's house saying, okay, what do we do about the towed cars? And Asante says, I have it. And he calls up George Weyerhaeuser's son. I don't remember how he had the number. And he starts this dialogue with George Weyerhaeuser's son, because it was Weyerhaeuser Corporation that was logging through a contractor who towed away our cars. And he was saying, look, you know, this was illegal. There were notices on the cars saying that we had 12 hours or whatever, and you didn't give us that time. And you know, you're not going to get away with this. And to make a long story short, he just bluffed and just like, we have lawyers, da da da, as if we had lawyers. And went on and on, you know, in this aggressive vein with this guy. And we're going, yeah, right, whatever, Asante. And he sends us this letter. The Weyerhaeuser Corporation sends us this letter. They pay for the vehicles all to be unimpounded. So we got Weyerhaeuser Corporation to pay for the vehicles. And meanwhile, the Forest Service is totally convinced that we couldn't have escaped their dragnet. And so they shut down the sale for, what was it, 1 or 3 days or something? Like at least
long enough for us to get the moratorium.
Right. They shut down the sale because they were looking for us in the woods because they didn't think we'd escaped. So it was pretty good. And the end of the story is we did a series of direct actions like the tree sit and an office occupation Forest Service. We had this liberty to split it up between people doing direct action as a small affinity group and just planning that and doing nothing else. And the other half of the group was doing all the legal stuff in the citywide campaign and the picketing at City Hall and the phone banking, the letters to the editor and the fundraising. Yeah, and our infiltrators were helping us. We had 5 infiltrators of that campaign and we used them.
Oh, and they also trapped each other.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then one time we were at a rendezvous and there were 2 infiltrators that we knew were infiltrators and they didn't even know that they were both infiltrators. And they were sitting by a lake and one was trying to convince the other to do what? Something with a helicopter.
They were going to go sabotage the helicopter.
Yeah.
The guy working,
it was amazing.
One guy was working for the feds.
And the other guy was working for the Washington Contract Loggers Association.
They both thought they finally trapped somebody.
Right.
All the rest of us knew who they were.
So at any rate, we did this remarkable series of direct actions. We were in the city newspapers for months. It was a whole citywide campaign, and we won. And the Cedar River Watershed and the Green River Watershed, the drinking watersheds of Seattle, are protected in perpetuity. Thanks also to the vigilance of a group up there that's continued our efforts to make sure that isn't unraveled.
In 20 years, I'll be telling us around the circle also, probably. So,
you can remember it.
If I can, I'll remember it, you know. No drugs. So this is actually in regards to the Sea Shepherd campaign out on the eastern coast of Canada that just happened like 4 months ago, whatever point. And also there's other people in the circle who can feel free to please chime in with other tidbits and sort of humorous anecdotes from this experience. The crux of it is that the ship, we went up to try and interfere and stop the seal hunt in any way that we could creatively come up with. It was, you know, varying effectiveness, but at one point we're in the ice floes. There's ice completely surrounding the ship. The storm moves in, so our ship, along with all the other sealing vessels, are locked in the ice, and we're not moving. We're not going anywhere. Someone notices there's a sealing vessel, you know, a mile and a half or so away from our ship, and they're looking through binoculars, and they can see these 2 little, like, black specks walking out onto the ice, trying to continue sealing throughout the storm. 2 of the crew, like, jump off the ship before everyone else, and we're like, oh, shit, they're going off the ship, and so, like, everyone else is scrambling for, like, crampons and boots and gloves and coats, and we're trying to, like, all get off onto the ship in order to go and confront these 2 people who are, like, in the process of clubbing these baby seals. We hop on the ice when running, but we're not waiting for each other, and it's turned into this long line with a few of us in the front and most everyone else in the back. And we get to these people that they had just killed a seal, and they were dragging back the carcass to this vessel. The few people who got there first started, you know, talking to them and just sort of, like, dialoguing with them and about what they were doing and the effects it had and whatnot. And I was, like, right behind the first people who got there and were taking pictures. But in the meantime, the sealing vessel sees that there's all these people wearing black shirts with masks on, like, running at their sealing people, and they come off their vessel themselves. So there's at this point, there's, like, 5 of us with, like, 8 more sealers coming off their ship, like, running at us. But they don't happen to have crampons on, so they're, like, ice skating around, slipping around all over themselves as they're trying to come running at us as well. There's a confrontation that ensues, and in the process of this confrontation, the sealers actually come and they headbutted me, they punched me several times along with another person here. The whole time we're being assholes and jackasses to them as well. It's pretty much inciting their violence against us so we can all catch on video and appear the innocent martyrs. During this whole process, I had my lovely Earth First Pirate flag. I was, like, holding up in the air, and the wind blowing like crazy. And it was just, I think my side of my flag just incited this one guy to, like, he just lunges at me and grabs my flag, and there's this big tug of war happening. And at this point, the Canadian Coast Guard comes in with their helicopter and is hovering like above us. And this guy's grabbing me, and, like, he dropped his club, and he's, like, dragging me over to his club. I'm like, go ahead, fucking hit me. The Coast Guard's right there. I mean, like, you can't do me more of a favor than, like, fucking yourself over right now. And so the Coast Guard is there, and I think the sealers at this point realize that they're not going to be able to accomplish much with the Coast Guard watching. And so two groups break up, and they go back to their vessel. We have our media, and like, oh fuck, well here comes the Coast Guard, like. And so the cameras are sent off to runners, and they're like huffing it, and they're running back, you know, to our ship, and like three of them make it, but there were 16 of us on the ice. So three people make it back to the ship, and in the process of them going back, there's a few people in the back, and there's a few of us. We want to make sure everyone was like, no one, there was no one left behind. And so we're sitting in this small group in the back, five of us, with three people already like way in the distance, and the rest chunk in the middle, and then we're behind everyone, and the helicopter lands. like media, quick, here's our camera, get it back to the ship to save the footage. But there was no footage in that camera, but we did get lots of other footage, and it was really awesome. And so the helicopter lands, and these, keep in mind also, this is, you know, miles away from land, like on ice floes in the ocean. Just like, there's five of us, and we're like, well, fuck, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know, we're just gonna keep walking, you know, like, you know, like. And so this, the cops were like, hey, stop right there. And I'm just walking, I'm like, I don't see you, you know, like. And so they finally come right in front of me, and they're like, did you not hear me? Did you hear me calling you? I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were there. And they're like, oh, of course you didn't. Yeah, it's windy out here. Yeah, right. And so at this point, they hadn't received any like directives from their authority, like their top officers, what the hell to do with these fucking freaky like eco terrorists that are hanging out in the ice floes. And so they're kind of, they obviously don't know what the hell they're doing. So we give them, I tell them my name and my nationality, but I'm like, and they say, well, what are you doing out here? And I say, well, I'll answer those two questions, but I don't feel free to answer any other questions beyond that. And then they're getting kind of pissed off that we're not talking, because we agreed beforehand that we'd give our names and nationality, but that was it if something did happen. And so they're kind of confused, and they're like, okay, well, go ahead, go back to your ship. So the five of us, we keep walking, and at this point, though, this huge gap had developed between us and everybody else, and the three had made it to the ship, and at this point, an icebreaker vessel had come up and parked itself between us and the Farley Mutt, which was our ship. And then there was absolutely no, we lost sight of our ship because the icebreaker was between us. And we're walking, and we're like, finally get up, and we realize then the helicopter comes back up, and it lands, like, back to the main group, which is close to where the icebreaker is at. And we're watching them. Well, they just questioned us and asked us what we were doing, and they let us go, so maybe they're just questioning the other people that are on the ice. And we kind of sat back for a second and saw what they were doing. I'm like, oh, wait, no, they're dragging that person, and that person's in handcuffs, so they're arresting everybody. So, like, fuck, what are we going to do? So we're just, and like, the icebreaker's, like, off to our right, and the helicopter and our crew is off to the left, and people are going limp, they're not cooperating. And then three of us, we decide, well, fuck, there's this big hole between the helicopter and the ship, and there's nothing there. So we're like, well, let's just fucking go for it. And this whole time, like, we just kept walking, you know, like, wanted plausible deniability, like, I didn't see the cops, I'm sorry, like, we never once, no one told us to stop, like, we didn't run, you know, kind of thing. So we're walking, the three of us, and we fan out so that no one, so if one of us, so if they do try nabbing us, they're gonna have to, like, spread way out to get all three of us. And we're, like, walking on the ice with just cops everywhere. But luckily, this is a big bonus for non-compliance, because the crew, some, like, a majority of the crew member went limp. Like, it was taking, like, four officers per person, and, like, all the cops were tangled up, like, dragging off our friends, and they just didn't have enough people to come after us. And so the three of us came out, and there's only one cop between us and this icebreaker, and he has a camera, a video camera, and the person, Jerry, he just walks up to him, and he, like, the cop is trying to grab him and, like, film everything, and grabbing and filming everything, and he's just walking with his arms at the side, and this guy's, like being pushed on the ice. And so the other cops are, there's one other cop, he has to come and help his friend, like, arrest our friend. But this was two of us left at this point. And this icebreaker realizes that we're gonna get away. So it starts moving forward to try and block off our path, like breaking the ice right in front of us. And so we're going, and this, like, and all of a sudden the icebreaker's coming right at us, and the water is, like, you know, it's obviously freezing water, and this chasm is opening between us and the front of this vessel. And the person that was with me, Johnny, like, they're trying to kill us, Geddon. And I was like, fuck, I'm not going to jail today. So I go over and I hop this chasm, and I'm like, realize that our ship is just right there on the other side. And, like, at this point, like, I'm like, I forget all about the whole plausible deniability thing. Like, don't run. I'm like, run. And I'm like, my crampon fell out. I'm like flying. Like, I'm like slipping everywhere on the ice. And then I see people on the vessel. Like, they see me, and they're like, ah! And they're like, someone comes run down and then like hops out, like jumps down the rope ladder off the side and like crawl up it. And like, I think I'm the last person. I don't think anyone else. And then all of a sudden Johnny comes around the corner and like, he runs back to the ship and we're able to get, but like, yeah, but by the time we get back there, they'd already started barricading the ship. And so they had to like come out of the barricades to come let us in. So, that's my story.
I got this pretty crazy story that centers around the Black Mesa resistance down in northern Arizona. For those of you that aren't familiar, Peabody Coal has an operation on the Hopi Navajo Indian Reservation. They really, really want to expand it, and they're harvesting, calling up all this coal from this largest strip mine operation in the continent, if not the world. They slurry it using aquifer water under the desert to the Mojave Generating Station outside of Laughlin, Nevada. And that's ultimately what this story is about, but there's a lot that kind of feeds into it. 273 miles, they're slurring it with this water from under the desert to light up the casinos in Vegas and the strip malls in Phoenix and places like that. I mean, the whole thing is really, really bogus. And in order to do this, they're trying to forcibly relocate the traditional Navajo, or as they call themselves, Diné people, which means those who walk the surface of the earth, from their ancestral lands to the so-called new lands, which incidentally are downstream from the worst nuclear spill in American history in New Mexico. Relocation is genocide. As anybody who's lived, you know, whether it's in southern Appalachia or, you know, indigenous lands around the world, relocation is genocide. And the government, which is pushing this relocation, is doing so because it claims that there's this land war between the Hopis and the Navajos. They claim that it has nothing to do with the expansion of Peabody Coal's Kayena mine. Well, every now and then, this has been going on since the early 1970s, every now and then they threaten that there's going to be this deadline, and the last major deadline was February 1st, 2000. And they were saying that you need to sign this so-called accommodation agreement, which is neither, and it was drafted by John McCain, which means you would lease your lands for 75 years and then ultimately move off. And the whole idea was to wait for the elders to die off so that the youngers who weren't as familiar with the issue and hopefully could be bought off with alcohol and automobiles and satellite TV and all that kind of shit would just forget about it and not maintain the resistance. And for a lot of years, non-Native supporters, primarily activists, people like that, would come down and help these people with, you know, herding their sheep and repairing their corrals and hauling their water and firewood and things like that. And this has been going on for a really long time. Well, the last deadline, the so-called deadline when they had to either sign the agreement or literally get bulldozed off their land was going to be February 1st, 2000. So as usual, the call went up for all these people to come, and it went out all over the world. Some from networks that had been around since the 1970s. So, you know, they'd been to the United Nations. There'd been a lot going on with this. Well, you may recall that this was right after the WTO convergence in Seattle. So a hell of a lot of us that already knew we were going to be going to Black Mesa that winter went to Seattle. And we recruited a hell of a lot of other people that had never heard of Black Mesa that ended up in Black Mesa after Seattle while we were at Seattle. And that was a really amazing thing because when we got down to Black Mesa, we kind of drifted in small groups and individuals and everything else. And we started finding each other down there and getting set up in the different homes. The resisting families start doing support work. And a lot of us were anticipating a lot of heavy police presence. And there was. There were a lot of flyovers from the nearby military bases and just a lot of weirdness. But it was a really amazing thing to see that not only all of these people that were coming from Seattle, but all of these other people that came from all over the world to be a part of supporting these traditional people in their resistance. I mean, there were people from Europe, there were people from Asia, there were people from Africa, there were natives from North America, from South America. It was really amazing. There were delegations from Sweden and Switzerland and Japan and all kinds of people. I mean, movement musicians were there, and there were these base camps set up, and each homestead that was resisting was just this incredible community of resistance of some people who had been affinity groups together for years and other people that had just met each other. The natives themselves were really, really amazed by two things that, and this was the impression, I know a lot of them down there, and these were the things that they just kept saying to me over and over again, was number one, they were just stunned at how they have so much difficulty encouraging and motivating their own children to be involved in the struggle for the protection of their own way of life and the land on which it depends, and yet all these other people were coming from all over the world who could have been doing any number of other things with their lives. The other thing that really impressed them was it was very obvious to them that those of us that had been in Seattle had been really, really damaged from it. And I was staying with Louise Benally and her family, and she kept saying over and over again, Storm, I hear you crying in your sleep at night. What those people did to you in Seattle was bad. Why would I trust them with the future of my children when I see how they treat their own? I mean, these kinds of scenes were playing out on the reservation that entire winter. And I remember at one point, one of the things that precipitated this was this woman's nephew had died on Christmas Eve. A whole bunch of us were there, and somebody came and told us, my brother's sick, you've got to help me. What he'd been doing was is a lot of the kids to get intoxicated will bleed the liquid out of aerosol things like hairspray into gallon jugs from milk, and they drink it for the alcohol content. And this guy had been drinking this stuff, and it killed him. It killed him right in front of us. We ran up there, and he was lying there, and he was stiff, and his face was turning colors, and his lips were curling away from his mouth, and we were building this fire around him to keep him warm before the ambulances got there. And of course, it takes the ambulances like 4 hours to get up there. So, I mean, this stuff kind of thing was going on. And I had nightmares about it. And I was telling Louise Benally about it. I said, I dreamed last night about your nephew. Then I dreamed that we were in Seattle and the riots were happening again. And the police turned into these dead walking Indians. And it wasn't tear gas I was smelling. It was hairspray and things like that. And they started giving us ceremonies to help us deal with this. And talking about how startled they were at the way we were treated and how it impacted all of us when we got there. That winter's organizers conference for Earth First was in the Mojave Desert. And it was in this really neat and interesting place, I remember. It was kind of like this Mad Max type scene where there were these sand dunes and then all this old machinery. I don't know what it was all there for, but I remember all the kids from the cities had come out and they were like playing all over it and everything, and it was really cool to see. A whole bunch of us from Black Mesa, a bunch of non-Native supporters, piled into this van. It was this young woman from Minneapolis. She was really cool. She had this Volkswagen van, and like 18 of us crammed into this van and drove to the organizers' conference. A lot of us hadn't showered in a month. I mean, it was that kind of situation. And we drove there. Corbin Harney, who is one of the Western Shoshone spiritual leaders, he met us there for a while, and he, you know, spoke to the group for a bit and did a couple of ceremonies in the morning sunrise ceremony and things like that. And then he had to leave and do the Ward Valley gathering that weekend. And for the Ward Valley campaign, I think it had already been won by that point. It had already been stopped, but they were having some big spiritual gathering down there. But he said, you know, we had decided we were going to do the post-organizers conference action at the Mojave Generating Station, which was in Laughlin, which is like about 75, 80 miles away. The idea was, is it wasn't going to be so much of an action as it was going to be kind of a demonstration and a ceremony. And Corbin and his entourage were going to meet us there, and they were going to do a spiritual ceremony, and we were going to hold up some placards and that sort of thing. And so we piled up this van and a couple of other carloads of people that went to this thing, and with placards, and we had all these cans of paint, and we threw out plus all of our packs and all of our stinky shit. And we drove all the way to the generating station, and Corbin never showed up. I never remembered why. I don't know exactly what happened, but we're all standing around in this van and maybe two or three other cars. Well, what do we do? Well, what should we do? We drove into town, or at least the van drove into town, and pulled into this parking lot. And I don't know what it is about hippies and parking lots, but when a whole bunch of them end up in a parking lot, it's a really long time before you ever get out. And this includes activist hippie types, right? So we drive, and it's one of those like combination like hotel, casino, restaurant, shopping mall. And I don't even remember why. We just need a place to park the van. So we stop the van there, and people go inside. We're poaching bathrooms, and people are probably shoplifting things. And all of us individually are running around posting stickers up all over the place, thinking, oh, well, we're going to get out of here really fast, right? We get back out to the parking lot, and everything just bogs down completely. And there we are, and the security guard, who's this tall, skinny, old gentleman, comes out, and he's being really nice and polite, and we're like, no, we're not going to be here long. And I'm like, we got to get out of here. So I leave with a carload of people. We go to the generating station. I don't remember exactly how we got this idea, but it's like, well, we're here. Let's do something. And I had my video camera. I was working with a guerrilla video collective out of the Wild Rockies at the time. We drove right into the Mojave Generating Station, right past the security gate. There was nobody there. And we drove around inside this place for an hour and a half with the camera rolling, and I'm videotaping every fucking thing I can. And there's three other very savvy activists in this car with me who are pointing out everything I'm forgetting about. Oh, get this. Let's get this. And we're talking to each other by name, and we're oh, we can lock people down right over there. We can hang a banner from up there. We can do this. And boy, isn't it a good thing we're not some real assholes? We could do some real fucking damage in this place, you know? Nobody's paying any attention, okay? We leave, and we're everything. Everything, signs, phone numbers, you know, serial numbers on machines, anything that we can possibly document. We're driving around inside this place and documenting. Well, these other people came up that had been with us, and their claim was they're apparently the Mojave Generating Station does these tours. John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public can walk in there and get this tour of this facility. But it turns out it was only Monday or Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, and this is Monday when they were there. So these people couldn't get in and do this. And it was another spying operation. The whole thing was a recon mission to do potential direct action at the Mojave Generating Station. None of us had planned to do this when we went there. When the Native delegation didn't show up and the ceremony didn't happen, we just decided to take advantage of the fact that we were there. Well, while we're driving around in there and I'm videotaping all this stuff, one young woman walks into the bathroom with a spray can paint and all over the bathroom wall, spray paints, relocation is genocide. I don't know this. We're driving out. She starts bragging about it. I've got the camera rolling. Hey, I just went into the bathroom and spray painted relocation is genocide. And I went, well, that wasn't very bright. This is a recon mission, right? Bear in mind everything that the tape is picking up because that's significant to the story. Me and the people in the car, we get the hell out of there. We're not through doing our homework. We drive around. We find where the slurry line comes on either side of the Colorado. You got to realize you got Bullhead City, Arizona on one side and Laughlin, Nevada on the other. The slurry line is coming 273 miles from Black Mesa, carrying all this coal and water. It goes under the river. We're driving around finding all of the places where it's exposed, and we're videotaping everything. I mean, the locks and the fucking handles and the turn wheels for opening things and the phone numbers to call in the case of emergency. And we're saying things like, hey, wow, man, you know, the phone number over here that they give is different from the one they have over there. I wonder what the significance of this is. I mean, it was beautiful. It was eco-espionage at its best. I mean, I was really proud of this over. Yeah, except it gets better. Okay. We're doing that. We even go to the Bullhead City Chamber of Commerce, right? And we walk inside there and we're pretending to be like dumb fuck tourists. Types. And I look over and there's this huge aerial glass encased wall-sized photograph of an aerial view of the entire valley, including the generating station. So I go up there and I'm getting all this aerial what it looks like from the air. I mean, I'm really doing this right. And by this time, I'm getting really fucking cocky with myself. So we're getting ready to leave. And I walked up to the guest book and I signed it. I signed it under the name Seymour Labya, L-A-B-Y-A, and I videotaped it. And the woman behind the desk goes, sir, what are you doing with that video camera? And I said, oh, I'm just adjusting for the lighting, you know, the focus, blah, 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 blah. We left. I says, okay, let's find the van. Maybe we should be getting the hell out of here by now. We go back to where the van is parked in that parking lot, and the van is gone, and there's this busted can of paint in the middle of the parking slot where the van had been parked, and that tall, skinny, elderly security guard is just standing there like this, and he's really pissed off. And we drove up, and right away I realized something had happened, and we were in a heap of shit. He said, and one of the people that we were with goes over to start cleaning it up, and he goes, don't touch that. The police are on their way. And I looked over at everybody else, and I said, let's find the van and get the fuck out of the state of Nevada right now. I don't know how or why this happened, but the decision was we were going to go to the library and hand out leaflets about Black Mesa and the Mojave Generating Station. And we go over there, and sure as shit, that's where the van is. And I don't even know if they realize what happened. In retrospect, what we think happened was when everybody was piling back into the van to leave that area, a can of paint fell out, and the van backed over it and ruptured. And it was paint for the banners for the demo that we were going to do. And there was paint all over the fucking parking lot, and the cops were in on it. Oh, shit, we got to get out. No, we're handing out leaflets in the library. So I'm kind of disgusted, right? And I get into the back of this car with this guy that had driven down in his own car. Nobody knew him. I didn't know his own name, and I was going to take a nap because I was exhausted. And I start to fall asleep, and I hear this yelling and screaming and commotion. I jump up, I get out of the back of the car, and I look. There's our van, there's our people, and there's a horde of fucking Vegas cops. They're all over the place, and they're like grabbing people and arresting them and shit. And I'm like, what the hell? So I reach in and I grab the camera, and dumb fuck me doesn't switch the tapes out. So I go running over there wondering what the hell is going on, and they're on me like stink on shit. And they grab the fucking camera, and I'm like, oh shit, you know, and I'm... So the cop is trying to get the tape out of the camera, and he can't. And he's talking to me, and he's talking to me. So who are all these people? I don't know. I just fell in with them at a big camp out in the Mojave. Well, no, really, I don't know any of them, man. I just fell in. What's it? Well, we were going to protest some energy place, man. I don't know. And I was just videotaping things and blah, blah. And he can't get the tape out. And then finally, I'm getting really nervous. I'm like, this guy's going to break my camera trying to get tape out. And he's still fucking with it and fucking with it. And he's still asking me questions. And we start talking. I said, who are you? He says, well, you know, this, you know, what's wrong with energy? What's wrong with America? What's wrong with capitalism? And I start talking about cultural genocide and species extinction. And he starts giving me the speech about how it's really better than it was a couple of centuries ago. And you, if you work within the system, you'll do better. And so we're having this real heart to heart. And honest to God, we're two human beings now, the uniforms, the allegiances, you know. And my, finally, I'm like, why don't you just let me get that tape out? I don't want you to break my, nope, you'll damage the tape. And I'm like, no, I'm afraid you'll damage the fucking camera before you get the tape out. Well, anyway, he finally gets the tape out. 23 of us got these charges. And as it turned out, they dropped the charges against everybody except four people. One of them was the person who had spray painted on the wall. Mine was one of the first charges dropped. One of them is a young woman who is now in prison in Israel for acting as a human shield in Palestine. Funny thing was, I didn't believe them when they told me my charges were dropped. This was one of those things where I did not want to end up finding out, you know, getting shipped down or ID'd a few years later and then getting arrested for a bench warrant because the computer forgot to drop my charges. So a month later, I hitched back to Laughlin, Nevada, just to make sure. And when I was hitching back, I got picked up by this alcoholic yuppie who was one of those binge drinkers who was like dry for a really long time. And then he'd have a drink and he would totally lose it. And he had just done this. He left his wife and his job on Friday afternoon in Houston. And he was pounding a bottle of vodka and he was on his way to Laughlin, Nevada to gamble because that was his other addiction. And he's driving for a while and he says, listen, I'm getting he picks up another bottle of vodka and he says, listen, he goes, I'm getting really drunk. Would you drive for a while? And I said, yeah, sure. So he gives me the keys to his Blazer and I'm driving. He passes out in the front seat and the passenger seat. I drove right back to that parking lot, to the same fucking parking stall, parked the vehicle there, left him there, passed out, grabbed my shit and hiked up in the hills and camped and found out, yes, my charges had been dropped. But the FBI got the tape.
You've been listening to a special production of Earth First Radio. I'm your host, Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening. No compromise in the face.